What's up, brand builders? Stephen Horahan here on the Brand Master Podcast. And in this episode, I'm speaking with Professor Byron Sharp about how brands grow and what marketers don't know. Now, Professor Byron Sharp is the director of the Ehrenberg Bass Institute for Marketing Science in South Australia and is renowned for his work on evidence-based marketing. His book, How Brands Grow, has made a significant contribution to the field of marketing with both academics and practitioners. And in our chat today, we dive into the importance of physical and mental availability to raise brand awareness, the role of the primitive brain in decision-making, and how smaller brands can compete in busy markets. So if you want to learn from an influential marketing professor who follows the science and the evidence for how brands grow, then don't miss this episode of the Brandmaster Podcast. Welcome to the Brandmaster Podcast, a show specialized in helping branding professionals and entrepreneurs to build brands using strategy, psychology, and creative thinking. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Brandmaster Podcast. And I'm absolutely delighted to have on the show with me today, Mr. Byron Sharp. Byron, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to join us from South Australia today.
It's a pleasure. I'm at home in Adelaide. This is not too hard for me.
Yes. Yeah, well, look, I there's a lot that I want to talk to you about. I mean, your books are, you know, they're so unique in the field. They go against the grain. They've got, you know, the evidence to back them up. I remember reading How Brands Grow probably, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago or so. And at the time, I'm very much, I speak about branding, I speak about brand strategy, and I'm very much focused on helping businesses to find their competitive edge, you know, their unique difference, their positioning strategy, differentiation, whatever you like to call it. And I remember reading How Brands Grow, and I thought to myself, well, you know, how are we going to compete with all of these? So I want to dive into all of that through the lens specifically of smaller businesses. But before we kind of get there, can you give us a bit of a background as to how you ended up in such a unique field, science-based marketing? How did you end up there?
I think probably the pivotal long time ago, for a short while, I was the marketing manager for the university's commercialization company.
Okay.
And I had to find, you know, you start off and you think, right, okay, well, where's our revenue coming from? You know, which products are selling things? And it wasn't the business school. It was chemical technology, satellite signal processing, agricultural machinery testing stuff. You know, I went and saw all these people, and that was quite a learning exercise for me, because I went, okay, so the world out there needs knowledge. There's lots of things people don't know, and you do research and people pay you for that, right? We don't do that in the business school, right? Okay, well, maybe we should. So that's the start of what eventually turned into the Ehrenberg Bass Institute, which is, you know, by business school standards is amazing. I mean, it's huge, right? As far as, you know, numbers of researchers and corporate sponsorship from all around the world. But I suppose you'd still call it fairly small business. Yeah, I'm a B2B small business owner sort of thing.
Yeah, also, well, your work has, you know, because there are so many different schools of thought when it comes to marketing, so many verticals, so many disciplines, so many angles that people are coming from, even when you just talk about professionals before you even get into, you know, smaller individual solopreneurs, etc. And
the problem is that, you know, we all live in the world, the real world where marketing is, and so people... Oh, look, no, it's no different. It's no different from any other discipline. Humans just have this amazing ability to theorize.
That's it.
The story feels right. Remember, every single culture for hundreds of thousands of years, you know, would explain things like, you know, why is this, this Aboriginal story of the Murray River is was supposed to have been a, it was a giant cod, and it flapped its, as it, you know, it flapped along the end, and that creates the bends in the river. These, you know, they're wonderful stories and we love them, and they, you know, and we accept them. Of course, it was only a few hundred years ago that we started developing an alternative way of finding out about the world. And wow, that really worked. I mean, but it's mind blowing, right? I mean, science is just constantly comes up with weird findings that, that basically tell us, you know, those thousands of stories you had, they're all wrong.
Yeah, and you know, it challenges convention, and it you know, people get uncomfortable, I suppose, because they feel safety in what they know, and when that's pulled out from underneath them, you know, they kind of they lose their bearings, and
there's a lot of story of you know, because Darwin was part of quite a religious family and things, and there's the wife of a pastor, and she said, "Oh gosh, well, I hope Mr. Darwin's not correct, and if he is, I hope he doesn't tell too many people."
Well, that's it, you know. It's you know, new evidence is coming up all the time, and like we can have a completely different conversation about evolution and trajectory, and you know, what's changed in the past. Really since the availability of the internet, now with AI and everything that's coming down the pipeline there. But to kind of bring it back down and get more down into the nitty-gritty of the marketing side of things, as I said before, you know, the idea of mass marketing and evidence-based marketing, when small business owners look at that, it can be very overwhelming. You know, how do I compete on that level? When we talk about specifically mental availability, how can startups, you know, kind of get their brand to front and center, and then keep their brand top of mind with consumers in their target market, specifically around mental availability?
Well, you've got to cut through, and you know, I think so many of the great brands were built on you know, doing something creative and inventive that the world noticed. You know, you've got to have a good product, you've got to have talent, but boy, you've got to think of ways of reaching people, and you've got to work hard at it.
Yeah, it ain't easy.
Taylor Swift, you know, we forget she's very talented. Yeah, but she's been doing this for a long time, and she works really, really, really hard. You know, she doesn't need to do a world tour, really. She doesn't need to do this. She earns enough money from her albums and would probably be better doing that. But she knows, no, she knows she has to do this. You have to work hard, and you've got to go out and meet your customers. Yes.
Yeah.
It's their business. You've got other things to do. Yep.
Yeah, that's it. And you know, when you think about mental availability and you think about all the channels that we have today, it's really about understanding what's the most viable channel that I can tap into.
Yeah, for me, which might be any, you know, who knows? It might be, you know, direct selling TV, you know, those sort of things. It might be as simple as putting brochures in people's letterboxes. You know, I'm Basson Street says B2B, because we sell, you know, corporations support our research. And now, you know, I do the plug for Hal Brands Group for executives. You know, individual executives can come and learn from us. But we've got to tell people about that. So, you know, you see our researchers, you know, they're not just sitting back in the lab. They're, you know,
they're out in the field.
But we also pretty much see a, you know, hopefully fairly interesting post on LinkedIn from almost every day from Erambu Bass people.
Yeah, and that's
exactly the same. If you're running a coffee shop or a, you know, a new startup for, I don't know, some new. I was just reading one about one actually in Adelaide. They built this LED light that is very good for sports stadiums and things, because it doesn't emit so much blue light, so it does, it's much more friendly to insects and birds and stuff like that. Cool product. Yeah, but 99.99% of the customers in the world have not heard of them yet.
That's it. So innovation is the first thing, coming up with something new, but then getting the word out there, it's you know, that requires just as much creativity as the innovation. You know,
finding the channel and probably being lucky, I suppose, part of it. But you know, that contract that Bill Gates signed with IBM, that he would provide the disk operating system for them, that worked out as a good channel. Yeah,
that wasn't too bad, was it? It worked out in the end, that one. Look, you talk about the difference or the focus, I suppose, on attracting new customers versus retaining current customers. Obviously, it's one of the hardest things in business and in branding is to acquire new customers, to create the channels, to create the funnels, to bring people in. I mean, when you think about the stages that they have to go through to get to the point where they're even considering your brand, then to pull the trigger and go through the other side and actually become a customer. Can you talk to me about the balance of investment for businesses when it comes to putting their efforts into attracting new customers versus putting their efforts into keeping new customers? And what should the balance be there if we talk about, you know?
Yeah, well, the good news is you don't really have to worry about the balance. Right? I mean, this is what the science says, that really you have to worry about increasing mental and physical availability and reaching all people who could potentially buy from you. And if you do that, you'll get your acquisition and your loyalty right. One of the great, I think, positive things is we see loyalty everywhere, right? It's sort of natural. You'll get your level of a loyalty that you deserve. If you get really big and you've got lots of mental and physical availability, you get a little bit more loyalty because it's sort of a little bit harder for people to not buy you. Mm. But, you know, so don't worry about that. You'll get that. Will you get and win customers? Well, that's going to decide whether you survive or die.
Mm.
So that's fun, wonderful clarity. We must. If you can't write a plan that says we're going to grow without winning more customers. Now, I've heard some very overly paid executives say dumb things like, we don't need any more customers. We'll just sell more to our existing. And it's like, okay, well, that sounds possible. It does sound possible. But unfortunately, you know, this is the weird thing. Science comes up with weird discoveries. We've made this weird discovery. And no, that does not happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every bucket emits some water. And if you're not bringing on new customers, you know, over time, you're going to see a dwindling there.
There's a journal article we wrote once called, you know, "Even Growing Brands Lose Customers."
That's it. I mean, you know, it's when you're talking about so many, when you're talking about humans, you know, and how we're all different, how we all change, how our needs change, not just from
we even die.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's brands are this is very much my philosophy. Brands are living, breathing entities. You know, you can't be stagnant, you can't be standing still, you have to be moving forward all the time. And with that in mind, I also believe that because we're dealing with humans, we're trying to acquire humans, we're trying to, you know, appeal to humans, emotions, fears, desires, I really feel that brands do represent businesses as this kind of inanimate human entity. What are your thoughts on that? When we talk about loyalty, when we talk about, you know,
you and I have a slight difference in that.
That's it, and because
not just an opinion, but you won't hear me do a little speech like that that uses words like "I believe," "I feel."
The
stuff I know, the stuff I don't know, I can point you to. Well, the evidence suggests X, but you know, like, who gives? There's 7 billion people on this planet. Who cares what I feel or believe? You know, that's for religion. So you want to know what the evidence is?
Yes,
the evidence is that people do not see brands as people, and The evidence on this is quite interesting. I mean, it runs even from into neuroscience stuff that just clearly shows people do not process brands, like do not process them in the way that our brain looks at. Like the parts of the brain that fire up when we see a brand are totally different than when we see a person, right? We absolutely can tell the difference between animate objects and inanimate objects. And people are very special. Brands are not actually, this is, and it shows in people's behavior, brands are not special to people.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really care.
So let me ask you, Byron, is there a brand in your life that you use?
That's a misleading question, because out of the thousands of brands that I use, I might have some that is a favorite, right? It might have been, I don't know, the brand that my grandfather used or something.
Okay.
But that's quite different. If you look at it from the brand's perspective, you go, right, so we've got 1 million customers. How many of them are like that and think we're special? We go, oh, there's 7 of them. Great. Okay. So there's 7 who love us, 7 who have a special feeling of warmth and linked to their family, coat of arms or whatever. But, you know, it's basically there's 99.99% of people who don't have that.
So even if someone has, let's say, an affinity or an attraction towards a brand, let's say there's a sentimentality, okay? Yeah. There's a sentimentality, there's a loyalty. Can you see the...
You won't get many of these people and they will not give you lots of growth.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting.
Don Gorski... I mentioned my book, but I think a thing came out. He's just passed another milestone of how many tens of thousands of Big Macs he's eaten. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He is a McDonald's absolute, like, you know, super fan. But the typical McDonald's, the most common McDonald's customer is someone who buys them like once a year.
Yep.
There's hundreds of millions of those people, mm-hmm. and only one Don Gorski on this planet.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, he is a bit, I won't say mad, but he's obsessive compulsive. He has.
Yeah, look, you know, when you break it down into the numbers and we talk about the evidence behind it, it paints a different picture to, as you say, the stories that we're used to hearing. When physical evidence, you know, physical availability is also something that you talk a lot about in your book, and it's a defining principle of the book.
It's about being easy to buy, or, you know, people will not shuffle their lives around. You have to be easy to buy. Which, mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, it's probably a little clue to this. Years ago, when you, like anyone who studied TV, mm-hmm. In the old days when, you know, when TV was linear, even super big popular rated programs, more than half of their audience, like, who are watching this week, would not be there next week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd still have the same sort of rating because a whole lot of people who weren't there last week would now be there. You're like, what? I mean, we know people are loyal to TV programs, right? So people would say, you know, you know, I'm like thinking when I was a kid, you know, great. You go, yeah, I watch MASH. Yeah, you know. And so does almost, you know, all the population. Yeah, yeah. But they don't watch every episode.
Mm.
Like, why not? It's like, because people have got lives. They are not going to, you know, like if they're going out to sport that night or something, they're going out to sport. You know, they don't. So it just shows, you know, because that was a problem with TV. It wasn't super easy to buy. You think, well, what do you mean? It was free. It's like, yeah, but I have to watch it at that. It only comes on once a week at that time. That's not super easy, right? And so people would go, you know, do you watch that program? Oh, yeah, yeah, I watch it all the time. Did you watch yesterday? Oh, no, not yesterday. What do you mean you watch it every time? Well, when I say I watch it all the time, I mean I watch it all the time that it's on at a time that I'm home and it's convenient. And so, being easy to buy is incredibly important for us. People, as I say, people don't really care that much about brands. If they go into the store and your brand isn't there, they buy another one.
70% of the time, it works every time.
Yeah. if the queue to the coffee shop thing is, you know, like too long, you know, I do this. You just move on. Maybe
That's
I won't
it.
Maybe I'll go somewhere else. Yeah.
That's it.
You know, McDonald's recently has been McDonald's always focused on speed. And, you know, their latest are pushing people towards using the app, ordering beforehand. You know, their loyalty program is really a thing in disguise to just basically get people through faster.
So when it comes to loyalty, how much of that would you put down to habit? So obviously, as humans, we're creatures of habit. We develop our habits. How much of loyalty would you say is more habit based than loyalty based? So your example of the coffee shop, for example, there's.
I think you're asking is how much is it due to, well, that's easy for me versus I super, super, super love it. Is that what you're?
Well, no, like the question popped up because of your example of the coffee shop. So yeah. there's a coffee shop, there's a line, there's a queue. I like this coffee shop. I go to this coffee shop, but I don't like the queue. And yeah. I decide to.
Is there any person on the planet who goes to only one coffee shop?
Well, look, for me specifically, and that's why this came up. You develop these habits, and you know, you like what you like. Yes, there is another coffee shop. Is the coffee in this shop that much better, or have I developed a habit and a psychological need for this particular coffee? So if you gave me those two coffees from this coffee shop and a coffee shop down the road, I can't taste the difference. But I've developed a habit. Is that loyalty? Yeah. Is that a habit?
This scientist don't get too fussed about words. But we can see this behavior. We see this loyalty type behavior that people are, it's what we call polygamously loyal. But they'll tend to go to multiple coffee shops, but they don't go to that many. We always restrict our repertoires. So, you know, there's dozens and dozens of coffee shops that we could go to, but we keep going back to sort of two or three. And so that is real loyalty, right? I mean, they could be buying so much more, but they don't. But it's not super exclusive loyalty. Yeah, you know, like, okay, there's a bit of a queue there. Let's go to the other one across the road.
You can be dropped relatively easily, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but it's not total dropping, right? It's like we've known for ages, but we see it that people have, you know, repertoires, and it's like, oh my god, you were drinking Coke yesterday, now you're drinking Pepsi. It's like, yeah, well, sometimes I drink Pepsi. It's not like I've switched from Coke. I'll drink Coke again, and I'll drink Pepsi again. That is very normal behavior. But the really interesting thing is that people really do restrict their repertoire. So I often ask people to do a little thought experiment, like. Pretend you're looking at a supermarket shelf of, cream, yogurt. No, yogurt. Yogurt's good. There's lots of brands, right? So just imagine a shelf, 10 by 10, 100 brands looking at you. How many of those do you see crystal clear in your mind's eye?
One, two, three, maybe?
Yeah. And if you're a heavy yogurt category buyer, you might see six or seven. But no one sees the 100. Because there are just some brands you just keep going back to, right? And we see this when we look at your behavior and a longitudinal thing. You keep repeat buying. You it's like, yeah, you're quite loyal. Yeah. This is a fundamental thing. We see this everywhere.
So when it comes to visual identity, because we talk about physical availability and just to use your example of 100 brands, how impactful or influential is, a unique visual identity in that context? You know, we there are 100 brands.
You can't get loyalty unless people, you allow people to see you. If you're that blurry brand, well, you know. And this is what kills a lot of really small brands. They put their money into physical availability, you know, which may be, you know, maybe digital, right? You know, maybe like, you know, buying Google search or something like this, but they're doing something that is just catching people who are about to buy the category, right? And it gives you some sales. But the danger is you haven't gone to their heads. And so they don't buy again because they don't realize. Have you ever, I mean, you know, being like a big London train station, you see people giving out stuff, right?
Mm.
And have you ever, like, you know,
like pamphlets or something?
No, freebies, you know, like.
Yes.
You know, try this new orange juice, yes. Whatever.
You know, Martin Place in Sydney, that was right. Where you just walk past every day, you'd have free stuff.
Yeah. The terrible thing, yeah, so people think, the marketer thinks, you know, they'll try it, they'll like it, and I'll, you know, add this to the repertoire. But the real danger is that the only memory structure it builds is, oh, yeah, free orange juice. I got a free orange juice in Martin Place.
Yeah.
And you're like, did you like the orange juice? Yeah, I like the orange juice. And what was the brand? It was the orange juice from Martin Place. So next time you're in the supermarket, would you know what it looks like? Nah. Well, then it's very hard for you to go and repeat buy it.
So how do you close that gap, right? Let's throw out the idea of the freebie. Let's go back to the 100 yogurts on the shelf. You're a new yogurt brand. You've got a very unique brand identity that stands out completely from everybody else. And the consumer sees it and decides, all right, it looks good, let's try it. How do you close that gap?
I mean, I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but that's actually not the brands that we see are the ones that are already in our brain. So
how do they get there?
This is why brands use things like advertising and publicity. You have to do stuff outside the store, right? You have to do something. So, you know, and when I say the store, it can be, you know, a computer screen or whatever, but we see what we know, and you've got to get that. I often tell a story. Years ago, I went to visit Kraft, who are on the outskirts of Chicago. So, you know, I landed at the airport, car drive to the offices. And when I got there, I went, there's a lot of McDonald's in America, which of course there are, but then there are a lot of McDonald's in Australia, I think. But then what I realized is because a McDonald's in Chicago looks exactly like a McDonald's in Adelaide, right? I know I saw McDonald's. And then I saw lots of other stores, and you'd say, what were they buying? I don't know. I don't know what they were. Did you see other brands? Yeah, I saw other brands. And I don't know. You sort of don't see them, right?
Mm.
So the idea that we do some amazing packaging that stands out and sells for us, nah, it doesn't really. I mean, it sometimes.
Well, look, it's not going to to make you a household brand overnight, but we have to start somewhere, right?
Certainly, it's going to help. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah, when we talk about physical availability,
well, actually, I hope it would help. I suddenly come into mind a whole lot of brands that failed because they really looked different on shelf.
Yeah, look, you know, the examples of brands that have failed are far greater than the ones that have succeeded. You know, for every 100 brands that fail, you might get one brand that makes it. You probably correct my statistics there with something completely different, but you get the picture. But we have to start somewhere as brand builders,
you've got to get into people's heads, and sometimes it's not sometimes it's quite simple. Like Toyota is an extremely successful car brand.
Mm.
They're a pretty boring brand, really. Let's be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but do you remember in Australia for a long time there were a very consistent campaign, Toyota, oh what a feeling, and
yep.
People jumped at the end of the ad.
Yeah, yep.
Very consistent, very Toyota. No one else did that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not exactly, you know, you could say it's a bit naff and things, whatever, but it got into people's heads.
Mm.
Another thing they did that was utterly brilliant, on the back of their pickup trucks, you see a Toyota pickup truck?
Mm.
It has big, bold letters.
Toyota.
Toyota.
Yeah.
So they built a billboard on every single truck they sold. Wow. Mm. Whereas other car manufacturers, some are just so stupid. They put a tiny, little skewer logo-y thing.
Mm.
And I'm pretty sure if you test for that, okay, Mercedes one we all know, right?
Mm-hmm.
But lots of the others, I think Mitsubishi says stars.
Mm-hmm. No, that's Subaru.
A Subaru, right? See, like, you know, this is. Whereas the Toyota,
Yeah, it's unmistakable.
you did not miss that. So it's thinking creative things like this. But you know, the important thing is realizing you've got to do that. When people go to buy a car, right? So here's some lovely scientific evidence. The average number of brands they look at is two. Two. There's like about 70 brands in most developed markets, but people look at it about, I mean, there's a few people who
So
get.
why is that? Now, when you say that, the to me, and you will argue with me here, to me, that's a personality thing. Okay, so if people, I believe, which you don't like, people self-identify with particular brands and the way they present themselves. So, for example, Jeep, you know, it's a very rugged outdoors brand, and as someone who loves rugged outdoors, just
I'd love
theoretically.
to agree with you, but unfortunately, this research was done decades ago and was a big surprise to everyone.
So
Right?
just
The researchers went out looking for personality traits, perceived personalities in cars, and perceived and then personality tests on people, and assume, and were sure that there would be a correlation, and came back with, oh, it's really it's
Well, look,
so.
I can actually see evidence in that because have you ever seen like the most you know, ordinary car, like let's say a Toyota Camry or something like that, and you see like a Rasta guy in it, like with dreadlocks and stuff like that, and it's you just have to laugh because their personality is there, but their circumstances have put
It's
them
amazing
somewhere.
how conservative actually people are with cars.
Yeah.
So much
So look, I
with
can.
cars, you know, if I remember saying this, like, you know, your typical marketing lecturer says, you know, cars are important, big symbolic, you know, purchases of people, match their personality, signal to others. And then you look, well, you look on the road there, gray is the most popular color.
Yeah.
You know, the biggest
And in
brand,
Australia, white for some reason. I don't know why white in Australia, but
the big brands are Toyota and Volkswagen. And you're like, oh, right,
so
yeah.
why then? Why when we go to buy a car and there are 50 brands that we could choose from, do
Do we
we
only
only
look at a
look
few?
at two?
Because this seems to be a fundamental thing of consumers or buyers. It's true of industrial buyers as well. We've got other things to do. And we try to be efficient, right? I mean, we do this. We have genetic programming that says, don't waste time and effort. You know, because you've only, it's like we've built it, you know, you've only got one life, and there are all sorts of other things you could be doing, like, you know, eating and mating and, you know, important things, passing your genes on. That's what we built for. So we, you know, we narrow the list very quickly to some that we think are going to be pretty good. And then if you really grabbed us and said, but there could be a better car, we'd be like, yeah, I could have made a better purchase if I put a lot of work into it. Yeah. So why didn't you? Because I got a life and I made a purchase that probably got me 90% of the way there.
Yeah, it so the idea there of us having other things to do, we're human beings, we're trying to stay alive, you know, that
Yeah.
primitive
Very
reptilian
fundamental.
brain. How much of that do you think is
Oh.
at play in our purchasing decisions?
Oh, huge. I think it's a, because we see this loyalty, you know, we see loyalty in every single market we look at, right? It's polygamous loyalty, it's not the fall in love sort of loyalty, but we do see loyalty restricting of repertoires, not looking around. You know, I love using the example of, like, you go out to lunch with someone from marketing, you know, executive for a bank, and they pull out their credit card to pay for lunch, and you go, hey, that's another bank. They're, oh yeah, well, you know, I had this before I came here, and so they're like, seriously, you haven't got around to like canceling a credit card from a competitor? It's like, oh well, yeah. We've got lives, so we're a bit okay. So I suppose you could say, you said habit, but you could say loyalty is partly a bit of, I was going to say laziness, but it's sort of lazy. It's sort of efficiency too.
Right.
If you're choosing between, particularly nowadays, you're choosing between, so we all talk about cars. modern cars are, they're very good. So they come with like, 6, 8 year warranties now. You can't really go terribly wrong. Yeah, you can spend a little bit more than you should have. You know, you might, yes, but it's hard to go terribly. And we realize this, and we also realize I wouldn't know how to evaluate. Like when I'm really getting down to choosing between 7 or 9, I wouldn't even know how to do it.
So just going back to the car, let's talk about the Rasta man in the car, the Toyota Camry. He's buying a new car. Okay.
Yeah. He's getting a nice new car. It's exciting. It's a new car.
Now he listens to Bob Marley, he might smoke a doobie on the weekend, and he's going to buy a new car. So like what comes into play? There are 50 car brands.
Yeah, only a few will pop into his head, right?
Why those?
Toyota is a big car brand here in Australia. It has lots of dealers. Yeah, Toyota is quite small in the UK, isn't it? Yeah, it doesn't have many dealers.
I don't know. I'm not in the UK. I know I'm in France. I know there's a lot of Citroën.
So in France, you have Citroën
and Peugeot,
which are really small brands over here. And it's not that they're bad cars or anything. It's just they have way less mental and physical availability here.
Yes.
You went to an Australian consumer. Did you think of Renault? They'd be like, no. Why not? Do you think they make bad cars? No, I think they're pretty popular in Europe, aren't they? Yeah, but why didn't you consider them? I don't know. I don't know where the Renault dealer is. I didn't even think of them.
And well, when I consider car purchases in Australia, I have the car now. It's a Peugeot. It's nothing flashy. But I remember seeing it in Australia, and thinking that's a nice looking car. But then knowing it's a French brand and knowing the import, the cost, right. and the cost of parts and stuff like that. So going back
but
to
it
your...
Did, but it did get into your head. And so when you were in France, you the chance that you buy Peugeot is substantially up. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But the physical... it goes back to the physical availability. I suppose I would have been more likely to buy a Toyota in Australia because it's physically available, and more likely to buy a Peugeot in France because it's physically available. So,
shows up in their market shares.
That's it. So just to kind of bring it quickly back down to earth and give the smaller... Because, look, when we as small businesses read Byron Sharp's work, we're like, how do we compete? How do we compete with Toyota? How do we compete with Coca-Cola? How do we compete with all of these things? And there's the idea of non-targeted marketing, mass marketing. We don't have endless budgets. Let's say true, but mass marketing is more accessible to Coca-Cola than it is to your small business.
But they've got to sell a lot of bottles tomorrow. They've got to sell a lot more bottles than you have to sell tomorrow. So their sales targets are daunting. So it isn't really that different. I mean, the key thing is to if you're really small, certain options will get knocked out for you, right? So you go, TV's a fantastic mass reach vehicle, but that's fine if I am a Coca-Cola that's already in every single, supermarket and things. I'm physically available to pretty much everyone who watches TV. So hey, I'll put some money on TV. It's great, cheap way to reach lots of people. But if you're but I've only got distribution in surf shops in upper New South Wales, then it's you're not going to be using TV then, are you? No. Right, I have to find some way to reach people who find it convenient to go to surf shops in New South Wales, and so you tailor your thing for that. But it's the same. It's the same principle. Every day, as a small brand, you should be thinking, or a big brand, how do I reach more people? How do I make it easier for more people who can buy my brand? It's something that they buy this category. They buy me. It's okay, but I. How do I make it easy for them to do that? How do I get their heads?
I love the way with all the complexity of the scientific research, the answers to the questions are like, Just they're so simplistic, you know, because, you know, at the end of the day, we're trying to get in front of people. Where do they go? How often do they go there?
It's not, you could say it's simple, but it's not, Newtonian physics is simple, but it certainly opens your mind up to, wow, I can think of a thousand other ways it could have been. Oh, but it's not. Okay. Wow. That's okay. And then creatively doing that is, I think it was Andrew Ehrenberg who said, you know, the Newton's laws of physics don't tell Boeing engineers how to make the next plane. I mean, you can't make a plane without knowing them, but it's going to require lots of creativity, lots of testing, lots of, you know, it's going to require lots of different things. And it's going to be different if you're building rockets than if you're building planes or if you're firing, you know, it's just different things. So that's where the creativity comes in. But the science really helps us understand, like, prior to this, we were all into, I'm sure I can cross-sell enormous amounts to my existing customers and I can get people to fall in love. And, you know, if they buy the category 8 times a year, they can buy me 8 times a year. And, you know, all these things that sounded possible but turn out to be, we have this huge emphasis in marketing communications of persuading people, telling them, I've got to convince them that my brand is best. Whereas it's like, no, that's be nice, but they'll find out what you're like after they've tried you. But the biggest thing is you got to find a way to get them to try you.
Yeah. But look, to be honest, I could sit here all day with you and just go back and forth, you know, because you got some very, very interesting ideas. They go against the grain. Like I read Marty Neumar, Seth Godin, you know, I
none of these people
get ideas from
have ever done any research or looked at any serious
that's it. Like, you come at it from a science point of view, and I love that. I like taking you know, different pieces from everybody. But yeah, look, at the end of the day,
and I sort of suggest those people have probably never changed their minds in their life. They've never come across actually substantial evidence and gone, far out, that's weird. That really doesn't fit with my world's view, which is, if you ask anyone in the Ehrenberg Institute, they'll go, oh yeah, we see that. You see stuff and you're just like, that's really? That's okay. And you then have to work out, well, why is the world like that? Seriously, when people go to buy a new financial services product, like really expensive thing like a mortgage or something, they only look at about 2 brands. Really? Okay, well, that's what they do. So you better get used to it, because that's what they do.
Now you've because How Brands Grow was what, 2010? How Brands Grow? Yep. And your second edition of How Brands Grow, what year was that?
I don't know,
16
or something.
2016,
We looked at luxury goods and developing markets. We looked at a lot of, you know, does this apply in
And now you've got How Brands Grow for executives. Does this bring it kind of? Does this make it more accessible? More? Tell me what we do.
Easier to buy? Yes. So particularly for small businesses and people.
Is this physically and mentally available now?
Well, the middle availability is probably very low. I doubt many people know that we're offering this now. But
We're changing that now.
Yeah, yes, you're helping. Thank you. Thank you very much. But it's the first time in an individual, someone who goes, well, you know, my organization can't afford sponsorship but I can buy, I can go along. And then I can sort of try before I buy. So, yeah, I suppose it does increase. But it's very much for people who, is, you know, it's an advance. It's pretty advanced. We've got some very senior people who've enrolled in this. So it's people who they probably read How Brands Grow multiple times, but they want to come and talk to people like me and Jenny about the implementation, and they want to really understand it to the point where they can, sort of teach it to, you know, other people in their organizations or answer questions when people. But you know, what does that mean for our sponsorship? So wait on, how should we be evaluating our sponsorship then? You know, or something, you know, like we sponsor sports events. Is that gets us, you know, so how would we compare that to, I don't know, the money we're spending on influencers or whatever? And to have that deep understanding that you can make calls on that sort of stuff.
Now, I believe you're doing a tour with the book, are you? Where can, are you?
No, How Brands Grow for Executives is in Singapore in 6 weeks' time.
Mm-hmm.
And in Bordeaux, France, you'll be very pleased to hear, in June, I think.
Okay.
And Boston and the States later in the year.
Okay, so where can people go to find out more?
If they look me up on LinkedIn or look Aaron Bubess or just type Aaron Bubess.
Okay. We'll drop those.
Online, we're pretty hard to find. We're pretty easy to find. If you want to physically find,
That's it. Well, look, it's Byron, it has been an absolute pleasure. It's been a different conversation to the to every other.
From what you're expecting?
No, not from what I was 100% expecting this based on your books. But the conversations the questions go in different directions. On one hand, it's, you know, heavy science based evidence. On another hand, it's just simple logic, and you know, the kind of dance between the two was super interesting. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us. If you do have something coming up that you want to chat about in the future, I'd be more than happy to have you on the show again. As I said, I could go back.
Repeat buying. Loyalty.
That's it.
Wow.
That's it. Mental and physical availability, and you know, we'll
you know where I am.
That's it. So, as I said, thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and I hope to speak to you again soon.
Okay, thank you.
Want to take a second to show some appreciation? I appreciate every single one of our listeners, but I have a soft spot for listeners who share the love. A shout out to Hershey Kiss from the United States. Dynamite content to build powerhouse brands. I love the depth of insight and industry-leading perspective Stephen shares on this podcast. I really appreciate your review, Hershey Kiss. If you want to share the love and possibly get a shout out on the podcast, please take a couple of minutes to leave a review on your favorite platform. We really hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to learn more brand strategy techniques to level up your skills, make sure you check out brandmasteracademy.com. There's plenty of free resources and premium content for you to download and get you going. If you'd like to join our Facebook group full of like-minded brand strategists, all learning from each other, then find us by searching for the Brand Strategy Community, where you can find exclusive content for members as well. If you enjoyed this content, please be sure to give us an honest review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listened. And make sure you tune in for the next episode of the Brand Master Podcast.